It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Andy Anako's here. Renee Ritchie's here. We'll have our one-week-in review of the iMac Pro. We'll talk about, of course, Apple's response to the big Intel security flaw and a look at what weird and interesting products are coming out for Apple at CES. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 592, recorded Tuesday, January 9th, 2018. Shlomo, Guillermo, and Alyosha. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Make 2018 your most productive year yet. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/MacBreak. And by Texture, access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Try it free for 14 days at texture.com/twit. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com/MacBreak to save 20% off any order. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the world, the wonderful world of Apple. Joining me right now, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, tech reporter, and man about town, Andy Anako, who is fitting out his new studio. I love the framed poster of the woman in the 1984 commercial wielding the sledgehammer. That is, where'd you get that?
Oh, that's like if you look carefully, that's for the anniversary of the iPod. They doctored it and added like an iPod.
Oh, she's wearing an iPod
and headphones to her
on her hip.
Yeah. I'm at the stage of moving into the new office and the new place where like my artwork is now like leaning against walls where I might be hanging it up. It depends if I find better places for it. So it'll give me another 8 months and I'll finally have nails and walls. But yes, that's a very good candidate. It's either going to be shelves or the 1984 lady my MacBreak Weekly.
Thanks to Joe Knoll for that. Yeah, he gave us wooden,
so handsome
carved versions of our MacBreak Weekly album art, and each one had the hosts. So it says Leo Laporte and Andy Anako, as if Renee Ritchie does not exist. Don't worry, Renee. We're not giving you short shrift. Renee Ritchie from iMore.com. Yeah, he has one that says Leo Laporte and Renee Ritchie. And you will. Is it next week your new studio? You're still in the old studio.
So I'm moving out. I'm moving out on Thursday, and then I move into the next place next Friday. So you won't. You'll see me at some interim place, maybe George's place next week, and then I should be in the new place.
Yeah,
at least partially set up. I'll be at Andy status.
When that time comes, we will acknowledge your new studio. I promise.
Thank you. We're working on it, Leo.
Meltdown Inspector.
Talk about MacBreak.
1 week ago, we kind of actually, it's funny. Right after MacBreak Weekly, Steve talked about both problems, but in such a even tone that I didn't really get the consequences, but now we know, of course. The next day, the researchers revealed the story. We only knew that something was going on.
But it leaked, right? It leaked a week before the embargo.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, yeah, and so it leaked because the Linux folks were working on it in public, as open source projects do. They redacted comments and stuff, but smart people were able to look at it and go, they're fixing something pretty significant here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The significance is, of course, it affects every modern processor, in all Intel processors since 1995. AMD too, and for about a minute, AMD got to skate, but no, it turns out AMD too.
They were all so busy trying to make it sound like it wasn't them like Intel was saying it's everybody, it's not just us, and AMD saying it's not us, and ARM was honest to the manufacturers.
The only computers it doesn't affect is your Apple Watch. Apple was a great pain to say it does not affect the Apple Watch.
Yeah. Because
and the Raspberry Pi, because they're so dumb, neither one does speculative execution.
Yes.
That's one way. So it's not done, Leo. We don't make them feel bad about it.
Slow.
This is like that dystopian future in which the resistance does everything with handwritten notes and typewriters.
It's Battlestar Galactica.
It's the only way that the system, yeah.
It's the Galactica. The Apple Watch is the Galactica of the tech world. So, and we've covered it. I think on every show except this one, because we're making full circle, and Steve's going to do a full breakdown on Security Now today. But just in brief, it takes advantage of a flaw in all modern processors. They look ahead. They say, is Andy going to take a left turn or a right turn at the next intersection? The processor guesses, I think it's the left turn. And then, and this is critical, loads the level one cache with data that it will need if Andy takes a left turn. And that data is not invisible to other processes running on the processor. So the processor can snoop into the future a little bit. And if that clump of data in the cache happens to contain a password, credit card, or something of value, it can be extracted.
My favorite analogy I heard was, imagine like Leo every day at midnight goes and makes a snack, puts together a sandwich. So his computer decides, I'm going to make the sandwich for Leo. It's faster. But then Leo just sleeps through the night. They're like, oh, we have to quickly put everything back in the fridge. But you can see that someone has pawed through all the cold cuts and cheeses.
Yes.
Yeah. Tasty. Last week I was using the Devil's Wears Prada thing, where you have a really demanding boss. You know that when she comes in at 8:15 in the morning, she's going to either want coffee or tea, but you're a really good assistant, so you decide to make, you don't know which one it's going to be, but you know it's going to be one of these two, so you make both, and then you get rid of the one you don't have to use. And then, you know, there should be like a compilation of analogies made to explain one of the most complicated things about system architecture so that it's actually reachable and relevant.
Yeah. In any event, it's – well, actually, maybe Randall gets the nod for his XKCD column, which actually boils it down to the most important advice. So it's a kind of a normal guy and a smart woman. The Meltdown Spectre exploits use speculative execution. What's that? Well, you know the trolley problem? Well, for a while now, CPUs have basically been sending trolleys down both paths, quantum style, while awaiting your choice. Then the unneeded phantom trolley disappears. The phantom trolley isn't supposed to touch anyone, but it turns out you could still use it to do stuff. And it can drive through walls.
That sounds bad.
Honestly, I've been assuming we were doomed ever since I learned about Rowhammer.
What's that?
If you toggle a row of memory cells on and off really fast, you can use electrical interference to flip nearby bits and...
Do we just suck at computers?
Yep, especially shared ones.
So you're saying the cloud is full of phantom trolleys armed with hammers?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. I'll install updates.
Good idea. Update. The good news is, in the Apple ecosystem, it's a kind of homogenous ecosystem. So Apple has been able to patch everything, right?
They've begun to mitigate. So back in December, they pushed out iOS and macOS updates, and they pushed out new ones already. So Meltdown is mitigate these things. We don't know for sure they're going to keep doing mitigations for these things, but they've at least begun to mitigate Meltdown. And now yesterday in Safari for iOS and macOS, and going back three versions of macOS, they've done mitigations for Spectre. Apple TV doesn't have WebKit Surface, so it doesn't need those.
They pointed out, and this was a little scary, that Spectre can be done through a browser and JavaScript. So browsers have to be patched to prevent that. And the reason that's scary is, think about the attack surface here. You either have to get somebody to get some program on your, some rogue program on your system that's running at the same time as you're doing other stuff to do the snooping. If you're on a shared system, like on a web server or, you know, iCloud, and you've got one process.
Amazon Web Services,
Azure. You've got multiple people using the same processor, then one of those people could be rogue and see all and look at the cache as it's loaded for all the other processes. That's really the most risky attack vector. But if you think about it, that's really how this happens. But it's scary to think that it could be done in a browser, because that means you could go to a website with some malicious JavaScript, whether it's a malicious site or not. This happens all the time. Injecting
like an
JavaScript.
Ad bundle, for example. Yeah.
Well, I just saw a really interesting article where I think this is on Medium's back channel. It was one of the Hacker Noon, where he says, I'm not saying I did this.
Yeah. Oh, God.
That was really interesting.
He basically, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You do it.
No, but just basically, he initiated a hypothetical scenario under the term, sounding as though he'd actually done it, but where you have an open source project, and he basically wrote a simple like little JavaScript tool for adjusting the color of text, and it also has a payload that does something malicious. And rather than, you know, writing this as a malicious piece of software and putting it in an app store, he just simply added it to a very malicious code to what would be a very popular core tool of suites that developers might use to deliver ads for, to deliver web pages for. And so once people start subscribing and using this this code package, they're essentially, unbeknownst to them, helping spread this malignancy on his behalf. So essentially, that's how you could get a simple JavaScript exploit in the field to deploy through amazingly diverse array of channels without having the, hey, just, hey guys, don't, there's an app called Pokemon Harvester, don't download this one app because it's this code that is being downloaded by ad servers and used in the background of so many sites you might be using.
So that's a good example of how, you know, a really legitimate site using Node, for instance, might, by loading a package that decided to use colored syntax coding, third hand load in this little, and it doesn't take much malicious JavaScript that would then take advantage of Spectre.
But that shows how fast this was changing. It's like initially they were like, Meltdown is bad, but we can mitigate it. Potentially Spectre is worse, but it's also much harder to exploit. And then, oh no, JavaScript proof of concept.
Yeah.
The next day.
Bad news.
And it's just, it's moving so quickly.
And it's one of the reasons that the mitigations are continuing.
Yeah.
Because what I think happens initially, the first mitigation you do is you say, well, stop speculative execution or stop allowing one process to see the L1 cache of another process. But in every case, it has a severe impact on performance.
Well, I think also, and like Steve can say this much better than I, but they can't fix Meltdown and Spectre because their chip architectures, all they can do is try to prevent known exploits for them, but they can't prevent unknown exploits for them. And so now they're stopping the JavaScript stuff, but someone could invent something else.
Right.
So they have to, it's like forward moving security and protection.
Well, I mean, ultimately you fix it by changing how processors perform, but you don't want to impact performance as the register predicted 5 to 30%. Apple pointed out that its fix for Safari, which pushed out yesterday on iOS and macOS, is at worst 1 to 2%. Nothing you'd notice.
Yes, on two of the benchmarks, it was 0%. On one, it was 2.5%. The worst I've seen is Epic Games put out a thing on one of their games saying that it was being impacted
Fortnite.
By close to 20. Yeah, Fortnite.
Yeah, you're generally talking about super high performance apps. Most people they can benchmark and see a difference, but they probably won't notice a difference. But this is going to be a big problem for like gaming. And of course, this came right before CES, right before the CEO of Intel has the big colored stage and the huge jumbo screens keynote. And he decided to address that. He decided to slip that into his
Brian
keynote.
Brian Krzanich, what did he say about it, the CEO of Intel?
He talked about all the money he was going to give him from the stock sale.
Yeah, he sold a huge amount of stock right before.
After Intel knew, but before Intel disclosed. But he says he didn't know.
I don't think that would be so stupid and so easily prosecuted that I can't imagine he did it on purpose. But anyway.
That's right. Well, also, at that level, you have a way to do profit-taking that is not going to get you in jail. There's a way to do that.
It was a little suspicious that he sold the maximum amount of stock he could sell.
Either way, selling that much stock is not a great sign.
That's hard. Basically, he was suffice to say, it's a 180 from what Intel was saying when this news first came out. That it, essentially acknowledging the scope of the problem, thanking its many partners for helping them to address it, and promising that Intel will have updates for more than 90% of systems that could be affected. Excuse me, of CPUs that could be affected, and the rest
Today
of them by the end of January.
Here's
Brian Krzanich at CES. This is the keynote that he gave, and this is the 2 minutes that he devoted to Spectre and Meltdown.
Before we start, I want to take a moment to thank the industry for coming together for another purpose.
Saving our butts.
Security research findings reported as Meltdown and Spectre. And the collaboration among so many companies to address this industry-wide issue
that we caused
across several different processor architectures has been truly remarkable. Security is job number one for Intel and our industry. So the primary focus of our decisions and discussions have been to keep our customers' data safe. As of now, we have not received any information that these exploits have been used to obtain customer data. And we're working tirelessly
the
on
bad
these
people
issues
are that good.
To ensure it stays that way.
You know, the greatest thing, he's got superimposed over his head, keeping data safe. Now,
yep.
I'm not sure that...
Make Intel great again.
Yeah. It's is very much, truth is lies and victory is peace.
Spacecraft.
It's, don't pay no attention to what he's saying. We're keeping data safe.
The best thing you can do to make sure your data remains safe is to apply any updates from your operating system vendor and system manufacturer as soon as they become available. For our processors and products introduced in the past 5 years, Intel expects to issue updates for more than 90% of them within a week, and the remaining by the end of January. We believe the performance impact of these updates is highly workload dependent. And as a result, we expect some workloads may have a larger impact than others.
This was the same line they use in the press release.
Yep.
Which is kind of fudge words because, of course, if there's no workload, it will not impact it. It's workload dependent doesn't really say anything. Yeah.
Also, despite what I said a moment ago, it really, if it's a big, big problem, if the only people that are going to be affected by a speed hit are the people that really depend on speed.
The more you'll notice.
Today, as fast as you checked your email yesterday.
When you're screwing around, that cursor will be blinking in that empty Microsoft Word window just as fast as it was before this.
We'll continue working with the industry to minimize the impact on those workloads over time.
So Intel, AMD, ARM, and the ARM manufacturers like Qualcomm, Exynos, Samsung, and of course Apple will probably do microcode patching. And I'll wait and see what Steve says about this, but that modifies the processor's performance. That would probably take a hit, but it'd also be the best way to mitigate this because when we talked about this last week, Steve said, it wouldn't be so hard and probably wouldn't be so hurtful to tell processes, you don't get access to this ring zero information. You don't get access to this. This is system information. And just prevent that. They should never have had access to that. And that was the implication we got from Linus Torvalds' messages on the Linux mailing list. He's the creator of Linux. And he was very critical of Intel. He said, how long do we have to put up with Intel's crap? So he blamed Intel. He felt like Intel did not implement speculative execution properly. But we should again say it's other processors are also suffering the same thing. I'm not technical enough to know, but I'm sure Steve will explain it to us later.
A story this big, it really does take a week to figure out exactly how bad, realistically, all these things are, what the solutions are going to be. But I'm glad I didn't have to write about it Tuesday night because Tuesday night, all I was reading from like the papers and the technical papers and like technical boards is that. That sounds like the worst thing that could possibly happen, and that computers are now over.
I didn't get to sleep Tuesday night because I was just sorting through stuff as it happened.
I think Today Show kind of said that. They don't to get rid of your Mac. It's not safe. But
they were a lot of Apple, like a lot of places just covered it as an Apple story. Apple slowing down computers again. Yeah. Apple hit by a crushing CPU bug.
That's terrible.
Mm. Yeah.
I have to say, we have an advantage being in the Apple ecosystem, or one has an advantage being in the Apple ecosystem. I use everything. But Microsoft's had a hell of a time fixing this. First problem was some antiviruses need access to kernel code. And so when the patch was applied to machines running many of the biggest antiviruses, including Microsoft's Defender, they got a blue screen of death. Mm. So then they told antivirus to fix this, and when you fix it, set a registry key so that we know we can apply the patch, which that sort of half worked. A lot of people fixed it but didn't set the registry key, so there are a lot of people who couldn't update their Windows. Today, Microsoft said we're halting the update entirely because we're getting blue screens on some AMD processors. So the advantage of being a heterogeneous system that we're
on targets,
you know what you're fixing. You control the ecosystem almost entirely. Certainly on iOS, Apple can patch it and patch it effectively. There, as far as I know, there have been no problems on macOS with these patches either.
Right. There was a small blunder where Apple initially reported that Meltdown had been mitigated on High Sierra, Sierra, and on El Capitan. And then the next day, the last two were gone.
Yeah. So you want to be running the latest operating system and you want to be running the latest version.
My guess is something went wrong with those patches, where they weren't ready when they thought, or there was something different about them and they had to pull them, or they didn't release them. They had to update the page. And hopefully we'll get them soon, because there are some computers that just can't run High Sierra. And there are some environments where your company does not allow you to upgrade for a certain amount of time.
And we got supplemental updates. If you're already running 10.13.2, you will have gotten a supplemental update yesterday, which I think fixes the Safari problem. iOS also got an update, which Apple eventually said, that fixes the Safari.
Yeah, 11.2.2.
Yeah. So you want
it's in the security notes. Like you click the little security link and it always takes you to the previous security link. Right. I don't know why that's the case, but if you actually typed in the new version, you would get the security page that told you that.
That fooled me. Yeah, because I was trying to read what it was doing. And I understand Apple doesn't want to be too forthright on what they're fixing, because that's an announcement to bad guys, this is where you should look.
But they were good with this. I mean, they named the bug, they used the proper code, they credited the researchers who found it. Wired had a phenomenally good story about the history of this bug and sort of like the three or four teams that all found it at the same time, because Kaiser was a system where you separate the kernel space from the user space. And they were saying, like, they were trying to propose this, and people were like, no, we don't need that. That's dumb. We don't. And then suddenly everyone was interested in it, and they go, but it has a performance problem. Like, we don't care.
We might want this.
And they're like, why are they looking at it? And then suddenly they're like, oh, this is why. And someone at Google's like, oh, I was writing these tests to see about this. And I think Intel said they were all disclosed within like a month or so of each other from these different teams.
Yeah, the synchronicity of this is very interesting. I think it was Brian Krebs who wrote about it, and Krebs on security, who said it's not unusual. Now, he actually invoked Leibniz and Newton, who came up with calculus at the same time, implying that there's just, it's kind of in like the
zeitgeist.
Air. It's in the zeitgeist. I don't think it's that. I think Rowhammer was the trigger, that there was an earlier timing attack that had a similar impact. And I think what happens is security researchers go, oh, that's an interesting avenue. And they all kind of start seeing, well, let's see what else we can do with that. So
they were using it as an argument that governments that find these exploits should disclose them because they can't predict that other people aren't looking for the same exploits. And if they sit on them, then we're all less secure.
Precisely. That's the real key on this is. And the thing that we really wonder about now is, well, did the three letter agencies know about it? And this is
an old bug.
It's since 1995.
Yeah.
If they knew about it. Now, on the other hand, it makes sense in a way, because it's going to be most useful in a targeted attack, because the information you get is really just kind of this, you don't control what information you're going to get. It is kind of a different attack than an attack that lets somebody, for instance, get root access to your system. It is an attack that extracts information from your system, and you can't really be sure what it is that you're going
to
get.
It's hard to figure out how to weaponize this properly, because I was talking to an engineer who was saying that one of the difficulties is that it would be very, very difficult to keep an eye on that cache in such a way that you weren't just by the performance degradation that your malware would be inflicting, red flags wouldn't be set up. The people who are motivated to do bad things will figure it out.
This is the list from the U.S. Computer Emergency Response Team of CPU hardware vulnerable to side channel attacks.
Star dot star.
I could basically say all of them. I mean, even
Newton
NVIDIA.
Message pad.
Yeah. Yeah. Effect. NetApp and Raspberry Pi and Technicolor, not affected. Those are the three. Everybody else, Qualcomm. Everybody else affected, Red Hat, Synology, everybody else. And the real problem is there are some platforms, and this is where you're glad you're running an iPhone, like Android, that the vast majority of devices will never be patched, period. So yep. The three-letter agencies, yep. Good news, you can continue to use this to attack the bad guys as long as they're using Android. It's serious. It's difficult to exploit, but it's serious enough because it affects so many systems. It's so universal. We'll move on. Anything else you want to say
It's a good wake-up call. I mean, we survived Heartbleed. We're surviving Meltdown Inspector, but it's a continual reminder that we built this thing so fast that we didn't really stop and shore up the foundations, and that yep. companies should pay attention to security as they're optimizing for performance.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. But the only thing I've been telling people is that you can't. It is a big problem. We can't really predict the damage that could be done by this. But it just reminds you that this is why you should make sure that you keep a close eye on your financial statements every single month. Make sure you check your credit reports. Make sure that you rotate your passwords regularly. There's just good hygiene it doesn't matter what happens outside in the real world. You can mitigate how badly you can be affected by it. You can't do anything about a nuclear missile coming in, arcing towards you. So that's true. But it also means that, well, the pressure's off of you. You don't have to worry about it. It's nothing you can do about it. You'll be obliterated before you know it.
Not a big note. Actually, you said something that's very interesting. I just want to highlight this, and I'm sure Steve will talk about it. For a long time, there's been kind of a general advice, just change your passwords a lot. In fact, some companies have policies every 3 to 6 months, change your passwords. And the National Institute of Standards, NIST, retracted that about a year ago, saying, well, the guy who wrote it 30 years ago just kind of made it up. And in fact, there are real reasons not to require password changes. It tends to make people use less forgettable passwords, less secure passwords, or maybe add a number to their password and wrote. And it's just maybe not the best policy, except now that we know there are ways to exfiltrate passwords that might be very widespread, it is good advice again to periodically change your passwords. So I think we're going to have to change our changed recommendation because of this.
Yeah, well, it always goes without saying that, again, don't use 123456. Don't even use 123456789 as your password. There's a reason why they publish a list of here are all the passwords that we keep finding online, and they're typically the same 20 in the first 50 every single year. Yes, you're right. If you're trying to impose a password policy on other people, you have to really keep in mind that you have to create something that is practical, because people will always find the path of least resistance. They're like water flowing from a mountain to the valley. They will not take the long way around. They will carve rock channels through rocks to make sure that they can have a password that does not stop them from being able to get done what they need to get done. But that doesn't mean that you can't implement them in a wise way that makes it work. But I think that especially in the world that we're in right now, one of the most important defenses you have against all kinds of maliciousness going out there is to make sure that if someone grabbed a password file a month ago, that's only be good for them for the next 2 or 3 days, because you're scheduled to change the passwords of anything that's important basically every 4 to 6 weeks. So it's you just like to not have to worry about things, and rotating passwords frequently is one of the ways you don't have to worry about things as much.
Yeah, well, I really think it's changed recommendation. The good news is Password Vault, certainly LastPass, make that easy. And that's maybe my job tonight, to go home and do something I don't really do that often because I think it's unnecessary. Well, I used to think it was unnecessary.
Well, I'll use Leo's passwords. Leo will use Andy's passwords.
Yeah, we should just literally rotate. It also is interesting that now we're seeing calls for, and I'm not sure this is the right idea. This is Jason Perlow writing at ZDNet, why Intel's x86 must die. Our cloud-centric future depends on open source chips. The theory being, if chipped architectures were open, other people could look at them, find flaws faster. Not that there wouldn't be flaws, but you'd find flaws.
Heartbleed got found fast enough.
Yeah. See, I'm not sure I agree with this, but I think that's probably what Linus Torvalds was saying, is we need to have open source chips. And I think there is definitely maybe some drumbeat now to get rid of x86.
There's just too much math, and there's not enough people looking at it all the time.
Yeah.
And we're so dependent on it.
Well, and I mean, I don't want to create a straw dog here, but it is also the case that there's incentive for companies like Intel to make their processors faster, and even if it involves cutting corners. And when you do that in secret, you don't know if they've cut corners. And I don't know if this was a corner cutting. It certainly was a massive performance improvement, which Intel desperately needed in the mid-90s, as you remember.
Yep.
All right.
Well, again, when gamers want 4K video at 120 frames per second, there are not a whole lot of ways to get that done. So making your computer safe has to be second to making sure that no other shooter is going to get the drop on you.
Yep.
So with everything, it's there's no such thing as a low fat muffin. They're just going to remove the fat, but they're going to add in something that's just as bad for you.
Well, I had this conversation earlier in the week where someone was like, I was explaining that some of these issues is because we want desktop class performance in all these devices. We want like mainframe performance in desktop devices, desktop and mobile. And what will you sacrifice? Yeah, we could make chips that are much easier on batteries, but they would be much slower. And will you give up your machine learning and your AR and your 60 frame per second 4K video and your shooter games and your 3D? And the answer is no. All these things, it's easy for us. We can just say we want everything. But to balance those things is non-trivial.
Let's take a break. There's still a lot to talk about, including our one-week-in review of the iMac Pro. But first... Well, I guess it's going to be mine because I don't think either of you have yours yet.
Mine. I should get my review unit in this week, so I'm excited.
MacBreak Weekly brought to you by FreshBooks with the year-end and the new year resolutions. I'll tell you what, this one of the big resolutions for every small business or new business would be to make a fresh start with your accounting software. Keep your books right with FreshBooks. I know you're saying, but Leo, I thought FreshBooks was invoicing software. Well, it is. But it turns out if you keep track of money owed you, money received, expenses, you're pretty much doing your books without even thinking about it. And that's what I love about it. FreshBooks intuitive dashboard gives you quick access to spending, outstanding balances, and something that a lot of people in business, I know I didn't, never know till tax time, your profit. Are you making a profit today? What's your total profit? You get all the accounting reports you need. When tax time comes around, you'll be very happy. And with FreshBooks, yes, you can make invoices really easily. Beautiful invoices that get you paid faster because you can now, with FreshBooks, accept credit card payment from your clients online. That means you're going to get paid on average twice as fast. And no more chasing clients for payments or waiting in line at the bank. Accepting credit cards is as easy as can be. Your clients even prefer it. See what invoices... Now that with Air Miles, we even get people wanting to pay for advertising with credit cards. It's really interesting. This is a big sea change in the way people pay bills. See what invoices have been sent, which ones have been paid. Most importantly, which ones have been viewed. No more, I didn't get your invoice. Yes, you did. I saw you read it. You can also see what's outstanding, what's overdue, and automatically even send little reminders. Makes it much easier to do the job you need to do. And now this is a new feature. I love FreshBooks because they're always adding stuff. Like every week there's something new. You can now create proposals in FreshBooks. Rich text, content, images, customizable sections. Really showcases the value you bring to your prospective clients. And it gets you started with the proposal on the process of doing the work, billing them, time and hours, expenses. It's all in there. Know what you did, when you did it. Never leave money on the table again with FreshBooks. Free for the first 30 days at FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. Let's start 2018 right. Your money's probably the most important part of your business. Let's do it right. FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. Enter MacBreak Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section, if you would. Don't leave money on the table. Get FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. We thank them for making MacBreak Weekly possible. So I have no real use for the iMac Pro, but I love it.
Leo, it's the best home theater computer you've ever.
No, I don't use it as a home theater computer. I use it as my main machine at home on my desktop. And I've got two cinema displays on left and right. I did have to get dongles because it has lots of ports, but not the right ports. It doesn't have a display port and it doesn't have a Thunderbolt 2 port. And of course, my cinema displays are, one is DisplayPort, one's Thunderbolt 2. So I had to buy the expensive Apple dongles. Okay. Same thing for drives. I don't have any Thunderbolt 3 drives. And actually, this is something I learned to my sadness. I had an Akitio Thunderbolt 3 RAID array, but it was only Windows compatible. Apple blocks it. And I don't know if there's a technical reason they block it, because I noted there is a hack, a kernel extension you can use that will let it work, but I wasn't going to do that. And when I contacted Akitio, they said, we can't fix it in firmware. You need to buy new hardware. So be aware, if you have Thunderbolt 3 enclosures and you really want to use them with your iMac Pro, make sure they're Mac compatible. That's too bad, but that's the way it is. There's nothing faster, though. Even that, I don't think is as fast as that internal drive. We benchmarked it here.
Yeah.
3.5 gigabytes a second. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I took a Motion Pro project that Anthony Nielsen created for Tech News Weekly. He renders it on his MacBook Pro. Admittedly, he doesn't have, you know, the latest and great. I don't know if he has, he might have a 2016, 2017. Anyway, he says it takes all night to do. And that's minus motion blur. He says, I don't even turn on motion blur. I couldn't, that wouldn't render in weeks. I rendered it with motion blur in an hour on the iMac Pro. That's the kind of thing that changes your life if you're doing that kind of thing. Played a very popular game, this Epic game that was slowed down, by the way. That's how I know the name, Fortnite. It's one of those battle royale games, 100 players enter, one exits. It's really a great game. It's really fun. But I played it because it uses metal. Apple's, you know, to the metal programming for the GPU. And I turned it up, everything up all the way. Everything all
turned
the way.
Turned it to 11.
Turned it to 11. It, you know, as most games do, it says, well, this is what I'm going to pick for your machine. I turned it even higher. turned off the frame rate gaining. I turned everything up, and it didn't barf. It pretty much stuck 60 frames a second. It's, you know, it can go faster. If I turned it down, I can go faster. But 60 is plenty. Fluid action, looks gorgeous. And, best of all, I kept other things running in the background. So, and this is the biggest change in how I use it. And I think this is actually a legitimate reason to want an iMac Pro, even if you're not doing, you know, motion blur in motion projects or rendering 8K video. You don't, there's so much RAM on this. I got the Rene Rishi model.
The 64 baby,
64 gigs of RAM, 10 processors because it's the fastest single processor clock speed, a terabyte hard drive because I thought I would be able to use these high speed external drives. So I'll have to get some if I'm going to do that. And you just don't close anything.
Yep.
So you're playing Fortnite, but you still got Lightroom. You still got everything's running in the background all the time. And I look at the processors, no problem. Nothing is maxed ever. I have never maxed anything, GPU or processor.
I remember when the first when the garbage can came out, the trash can came out, Guy English used to run Batman Arkham Asylum on one of those GPUs and Lara Croft Tomb Raider on the other GPU and just leave them going.
Yeah.
And you can do even more of that now.
Yeah. You feel like
there's a captive breeding program.
You feel like there's so much headroom that you don't really have to ever think about it. Jason Snell was on the new Screensavers. We talked a lot about it. And he uses Isotope to process audio. And he says that's a very slow overnight, another overnight program, much, much, much faster than his iMac Pro. So one of the things Jason talked a lot about, he got a briefing from Apple about, is the T2 chip. I know you've written about this as well.
Yeah.
This is
not affected by Meltdown.
By the way, yeah, simultaneously more and less than we thought it was. It's less in the sense that it is not a dual processor architecture. You're not getting an ARM chip and you're not running iOS on, but it's doing some really interesting things. For instance, the memory on this has no controller. It's just bare chips. The controller's in the T2 processor.
Yeah, it subsumed almost all the controllers on the inside that we usually ran on the Mac. The imaging controller, the disk controller, the storage controller, the memory controller, all of that just went right into the T2 chip to make it efficient and secure.
I don't have Face ID or Touch ID, but if I had the right kind of camera, I could do Face ID. And if I had a fingerprint reader, I could do Touch ID because that's what does it, right? The T2 is what does it.
So I believe that you, I don't think you could do Touch ID because it has a secure enclave. It does not have the neural network. Like it's not an A11.
Okay.
So it wouldn't do Face ID. But if Apple shipped a Magic Keyboard with Touch ID,
they could put an A11 in it.
Yeah. The iMac Pro got sort of this awkward phase where Apple's moving from Touch ID to Face ID. And I don't think they're going to. Maybe they'll make some, but I don't know if they're going to make much more Touch ID, and they're not ready yet to do Face ID wide, so this sort of shipped in between. Otherwise, I think if this had shipped a year earlier, it would have come with a Magic Keyboard with Touch ID.
Yeah. Actually, I'm kind of Apple's always good at making sure you buy into the ecosystem. The Apple Watch unlocks it just fine, and that's really all I really need.
I have Touch ID on my MacBook Pro, like I think you do too. And like I don't even like I, before I reach for it, it goes brrrp. Like I just feel a little.
And the little the watch gives you the taptic feedback.
Yeah.
And in a way, I am using Face ID to unlock the Mac because the watch is unlocked by the phone, which is unlocked by Face ID. And because the as long as I keep the watch on, it now is authenticated using Face ID. It authenticates the Mac. So it all works as seamlessly as one would ever want.
It's a nice trust chain because as long as you opened your phone, the watch trusts you. As long as the watch is on your wrist and can feel your pulse, you know, the computer trusts the watch and then the computer just opens for you.
The T2 is also used for the FaceTime camera. So it's a 1080p camera, but it recognizes faces to the degree that it exposes not for the background, not for the highlight, but for the face.
It has the image signal processor from I think it's the A9 or the A10 inside it. So it does everything that you'd expect an image signal processor in an iPhone to do, but on a 1080p camera, EyeSight camera inside, or sorry, FaceTime camera on your iMac Pro.
It really is cool. You get I've never gotten a better image.
Autofocus, auto white balance, auto exposure.
It knows faces. The T2 also controls the fans. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, even when I'm taxing this thing 100% as hard as I can, which was with the motion project, it gets hot. You can feel it, but you never hear the fans.
It also secures the camera and the microphone so that they can't be sort of hacked the way people worry about cameras being taken over. Yeah. That's all inside the secure enclave now, and it's sort of hardened against any infiltration into it.
It does a very good job with the microphones as well. It's got how many? 4 mics?
And it's got those big booming speakers.
And I haven't heard the speakers. I hooked it up immediately to my audio engines. But
it sounds good for an iMac. Like it's sort of like when the iPad went to iPad Pro, the iMac went to Pro, gave it those sort of big booming speakers too.
You know what I should investigate is what DAC it's using for audio. Because I have external DACs. I have a FiO DAC. I have some very good external DACs for converting the digital audio to analog for the speakers. But I just plugged my speakers into the headphone jack. I would guess Apple's using a good DAC. I would be shocked if they were.
Their audio team has been really on fire lately because we complained for years that Apple, the company that invented the iPod, had crappy speakers on the Mac, crappy speakers on the iPhone, crappy speakers on the iPad. And now the iPad speakers are great. The iPhone speakers have gotten better and better, and they're even ramping up the Mac speakers. And I'm glad they're putting that time and attention into it.
And the T2 also secures the boot, right?
So it goes right from the beginning of the boot chain, step by step. Each one secures the other one. So it's sort of like the security chain we just spoke about. So from EFI, is that the right way?
Yeah.
I think it's called EFI. Yeah. Everything from the boot sector all the way up, it just verifies one step after the other on the chain.
So if you wanted to install Linux or something on it to the metal, you'd have to turn this off. But there is a startup security utility that lets you control this, turn on firmware password protection, choose if you want full security, no security, medium security, disallow booting from external media. So that's nice if you're using an environment where somebody might come along with a USB drive with something bad on it. You can keep it from booting to that. All of this is really nice. And Jason did confirm what you told me and what we experienced when we turned on the iMac Pro. It starts with FileVault enabled because the T2 secures the disk. Yep. And then you can add FileVault as well, so that even if somebody took the whole machine, there's no way they could get into your data.
Yeah, it does it all in hardware. The T2 chip does hardware encrypt, decrypt live on the data as you're reading and writing it, which is really cool.
It's very, except for the price, it's definitely the computer you want.
The downside is that they are using expensive, like they're using Xeon W processors and they're using ECC RAM. So they're using expensive
there's
components.
And you probably
don't. But hopefully this will filter down. The thing about this is Apple plays around at the high end, and those technologies filter down to, hopefully they filter down to the low end.
Scooter X says that in the teardown, the iFixit teardown, which is definitely worth looking at, they identify the DAC as a Cirrus Logic DAC. I'm not familiar with DACs, but any audio file will be able to tell us if it's good. It's the CS42L83 audio DAC.
More and more custom silicon in there.
Yeah, look at all this stuff. It's probably mostly psychological, but I have definitely bonded with the slate gray iMac Pro. When you spend $8,000 on a machine, there's a certain incentive to like it.
You bought its love.
Don't let it into your head, Leo. That's what it wants.
Leo, I'm space gray.
Here's some interesting news, some exciting news. Apple is adding features to Siri as they get ready for the release of the HomePod. This is the standalone speaker that was delayed. It was supposed to come out at the end of the last year. According to Apple, on track for an early 2018 release. But the new version of beta version of iOS 11.2.5 sports a new feature in Siri. Hey Siri, give me the news. Will pop up one of a select few podcasts. You can switch between Fox News, NPR, and CNN. I guess you get to choose it. It's kind of like the flash briefing on Amazon's Echo devices. Mm. So that's, you know, I expect to see more features if it's going to compete with Amazon Echo. The default is a daily news recap by the Washington Post, but you can choose others. I wish you could choose more than just those four.
I'm surprised the New York Times daily brief isn't on there.
I love the daily.
I think that's.
Love that.
That's I would even say that's kind of an important newscast now to, these days.
Yeah, I listen.
But yeah, they don't. If they don't really let you have your everyone has if this is going to be what you get your news from in the morning, then they got to make sure that they support pretty much everything. And if maybe not to full bore loony, but just one click above full bore loony.
I want my Alex Jones. Damn it. I'm looking at the images from 9 to 5 Mac, and I notice on the right under settings, it looks like you could switch on the daily as one of their choices, okay. As well as Tech Meme's top news. So it looks like you can add more, which is nice. I use that on my Amazon Echo all the time. I really like having kind of you say good morning Echo, it'll tell you the date, the weather forecast. It'll tell you what appointments you have, and then it'll give you your flash briefing. And by the way, we offer, Twit offers content for flash briefings from all of our shows. So if you do use the Amazon flash briefing, make sure you go into the settings and look up Twit, because we have some good content. Mm.
I just really hope that 2018 becomes the year of Siri. I hope that they make Siri as important to their messaging, as important to their tech lineup as anything else that they're doing right now, because they're really in danger of getting lapped by their two competitors here. Google, which doesn't usually the huge companies like Google don't have a huge presence at CES because they tend to use their own events to announce and show off really cool things. But they are using CES to show off Google Assistant, and not only to announce partnerships with a whole bunch of new hardware manufacturers to do more Amazon Echo type devices that have built-in screens and can show YouTube videos and stuff like that, but also launching an entirely new like marketing site that says here is everything you can do with Google Assistant right now, and also putting a button in the Google Assistant app on the Google Search app that will just give you a rundown of if you have no idea what Google Assistant can do for you, here it is, topic by topic, purpose by purpose, things you can say, things that will work with, and it's hard to know what the real functionality gap is between Siri and the competitors. I do believe it's there, and I do believe it's substantial, but unless Apple really gets on their horse right now and starts saying, here are things that Siri can do, and no, it's not just that we added a simple read a news podcast feature that's been in all of our competitors for a couple of years now. They really do get I think they're creating the impression that Siri is just what you get when you have all Apple products. It's not the good stuff you could get if you were not using Apple products.
Yeah, I mean, Apple can't sit back much longer. You're right. Google's coming on real strong. They said they activated 6 million new Google Assistant devices at the holidays, which means they're catching up rapidly to Echo. Echo's not sitting still, though. One of the other things we see at CES this year is Echo everywhere. In fact, I just ordered this from Anker. This is the Roav Viva, which puts Echo in your car in a really interesting way. It's a cigarette lighter adapter. It offers two USB ports, but it also has a microphone and an Echo. And you could pair it to your, if your car supports A2DP Bluetooth streaming, which almost all modern cars do, you pair it to your Bluetooth streaming, and now you've got, you've Echo enabled your car. These guys are, you know, these are mature products that are getting ubiquitous, and Apple's just kind of waiting.
It's not just that. It's not that people associate these assistants with the Google Home product or the Amazon Alexa, like, cylinder product. It really is like that time when phones moved from clicky keyboards to multi-touch. And there were a couple of companies, notably, that don't really exist anymore, except for a sticker you can license to put on your selfie stick, that were really, really late in figuring that out and how important this is. A voice assistant is an app platform. It's a services platform. It is an entirely new mode of computing that can translate to watches, to phones, to in-car devices, to audio devices, to kitchen devices, to pretty much everything that's out there. And the longer Apple takes to really land that point that we you want to start investing in Siri, the more the harder it's going to be for them to catch up. It's not just the idea that I've spent a few hundred dollars now on Google Home devices or a few hundred dollars on Echo devices. It's that the more you use these things, the more you sort of program yourself to say, before I want Magic Voice to do something, what do I say? Is it Shlomo? Is it Alyosha? Is it Guillermo? And it's more and more, as I moved into this new place, it's Guillermo. And you really, it's
remind
it's
me again, which really, one's really, Guillermo? That's the Google one.
Yes, I'm doing a solid for all of our listeners.
Alyosha, Guillermo. It's the first initial. Alyosha, Guillermo, and Shlomo. Okay, I got it. Okay, yes.
I think
for
all
me,
that
it's not Guillermo. It's Alyosha. To be honest with
you, and that's fine. It's I will say that,
but in no cases it's Shlomo.
It used to be, yeah, exactly. It used to be that I had a house with like a much too big house for me. So I had a big first floor and a big second floor, and so it was like having two cats that fight. So I had the Amazon devices on the first floor and the Google devices on the second floor, and now that it's like a smaller space where it's a little bit more compact, and actually the first place I've moved into since I really had an opportunity to choose between one or the other, really, when it becomes head to head, for me, it becomes Google. It could have been Amazon, but it really comes down to Google. And I can't imagine what Apple could ship at this point that would get me to switch. And so I hope that Apple is, again, it would be something that says that not only have they really updated Siri to be a powerhouse, but also that they have a whole future plan for it that's more than making my other Apple devices more useful.
To me, it's super interesting because I think Siri still has this problem where like 9 out of 10, I only use Siri. I try to use Google Assistant and I hit this brick wall where it says, you have to enable us to monitor your web and app activity. And I just say no. And it says, well, you can't use us. And we agree to try again next year. But I mostly use Siri, but like 9 out of 10 times is fine. One time it just acts like I found that one server in the back of the closet that nobody's patched and has no idea how to answer any query. And I think until you get over that, that's really hard. And these are increasingly...
You really taught us that. And I didn't realize that the different servers on the Siri server farm have different capabilities. And the effectiveness of Siri can very much depend on which server randomly you get.
And also devices. I mean, there's a whole like the different devices can do different things. Like Siri on Apple TV is one of the most advanced assistants in the world because it can actually do multilingual. It can understand when you're switching languages, but it's only in a few countries. And there's no HomeKit on the Mac. You can't use HomeKit on your Mac with Siri for no reason, like just because Apple hasn't done it yet. And that's all frustrating if you hit it. And these, like we saw messaging becoming an actual operating system, especially with WeChat in China. And voice is going to be the operating system of cloud-based computing because it's just the easiest way to interface with abstracted networks in the sky, and there's a huge battle for it. And Microsoft had Cortana, and Google has Assistant, and Amazon has Alexa. I'm using Siri, but I saw this fascinating study from Ben Beharin and Carolina Milanese of Creative Strategies. They do great work because they have huge sample sizes of real users, and there's this, like, sort of discussion about how embedded in this is Apple far behind. Have people made their choices? Are a lot of people using these? And I had a bunch of different analysts on to talk to, and some of them think like this is just open. It's like open season right now. Nothing is settled. Everything is wide open. And others think that people are making choices. But what I loved about their study is like the vast majority of people who have either a Google or an Amazon product The top three for Amazon was set a timer, check the weather, play a song.
Yeah.
The top three for Google were play a song, check the weather, set a timer. And this is like the only one that even approached 60% of people.
Right.
When you get to anything advanced, like even a sports score barely hits 10%. Add an item to your to-do list, it's like 5%.
Yeah.
So it, in some ways, it still is really nascent technology for us.
Where it's going to be, where the rubber is going to hit the road is, I believe, home automation. And Apple, which really had a plan there with HomeKit, this is where it's going to really come down. Because it turns out talking to your lights and your garage door and your TV is really, I think it's going to end up being the kind of the thing. That's to me, you're right, those first three skills.
It's a better interface for those things.
But it's a much better interface. And so I feel like that's really where the rubber's going to hit the road. And I think the analysts who say it's not, that's not yet over are probably right. There's still a opportunity for Apple with HomeKit, but they better get going.
We saw at CES, for example, Kohler and Moen are putting out HomeKit-controlled showers and baths,
right.
And Amazon Alexa-controlled. But these are all still responsive technologies. They're still like, I wake up in the morning and I say, Siri or Doodad, start the shower for me. But we're going to get to a point
Shlomo, and Alyosha.
But maybe, like, I think Google might have the advantage here because despite Amazon's widespread, you might get up and it'll say, hey, I just noticed you got up. Do you want us to start your shower? We started your shower for you. And when you start rolling the prescience in and the machine learning and starts figuring out how to do things preemptively to make your life easier, we haven't really seen any of that yet. And also, mostly these are single task, like do this, do that, which is not how you, it should be like, we have chains and things, but you still can't.
Right.
Yeah, chaining, but stream of consciousness chaining. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. And also the multi-personal assistant, which Google is beginning to unlock. But I don't want, like, if Andy and I were roommates and I want to say, read my messages, I shouldn't get Andy's messages.
No.
So, like, and that's advanced voice recognition. There's just so much that we still have to do.
There's a lot. Google's ahead in those particular realms, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I don't think the race is over yet. But this is one of the difficulties that Apple has culturally, that sometimes you do really have to talk about, here's what we're researching, here's what we're working on. I don't think they should be as foolish as all the stuff we're seeing at CES, which here is a magical self-driving bus that will serve churros that you will never see anywhere outside of this keynote event right here, right now. But when Google knows that they really have to make sure that their assistant looks like a platform that's worth investing in, both as developers and as users and as hardware manufacturers. They spend a lot of time explaining about improvements that they're making just as simply to their voice system, and how they're showing you, here is actual human recorded voice. Here is the synthetic voice we built based on that professional voice artist's voice. Here is how well it does inflections on its own. I was using it just the other day where there's little inflections where it understands all the different ways that a human being says the word okay, which is to say that I acknowledge okay. This is the end of our vocal transaction. I hope I've pleased you. I will not be talking to you about this in the future. Or okay, meaning that I've heard your request. I need more information from you. On and on and on and on. It's stuff like that that is the part of the secret sauce that makes all this work. It's just kind of frustrating when Google is making sure you know that now you can chain commands together, and there are ways that you can make a command like, you know, put the house to sleep, I'm going to bed right now, and make things work. And Apple, they're willing to let you know that, gosh, when they have their own $400 smart speaker that competes with the other $400 smart speakers that have been around for the past year and a half, you'll be able to pick music in a much better way. It's like, okay, that's nice. That's a step forward, but that's treating it like a feature and not like a platform. They should make sure that they're treating Siri like a platform. I don't know who they need to send to what conference to give what kind of keynote, but they're not creating the impression that they're doing.
I have to say that there was one advantage Shlomo has, and that's the Apple Watch. I was just thinking, the one time I use Siri all the time is when I have my watch on hand.
Well, they have some challenges
and other stuff
get over. Like Ben Maher made a really good point too, that Apple, like, again, like, I won't use Google because I believe that they should be paying. I believe my data is valuable enough that it's not worth them just giving me free services. They should pay me for it. And that might be a crazy view, but it's mine. But Apple, like, my choice is not to use Google, but to use Apple. But I would like a hybrid where maybe Apple does take a lot more of my personal data, but gives me a lot more personal assistance and doesn't store it and doesn't use it for marketing and doesn't use it for, you know, to power AdSense or anything. It just, it takes the data, collects it, does a bunch of stuff on it, and then disperses it when it wants to. Like, right now, I feel like I have to choose all or nothing. I have to give everything to Google, or I have to go with Apple, who doesn't want to take anything. And I don't sort of get the ideal that I want from either of them. And the challenge on the Google side is they seem philosophically insistent that their assistant have no personality, that it be computer. And there's a lot of people, Carolina was talking about this too, that just feel off put. They would much rather speak to an Amazon or Apple assistant that has a name and feels like a character, like, yes, like a funny robot,
yeah,
out of
Google
Pixar,
is not,
and not to something cold like, cold like Google. So they all have these philosophical things that I wish they'd get past. Yeah.
I think if you take the long view, it is early days for all of these. They're only slightly useful now, and there's still plenty of opportunity for Apple to get in the game. But
their input zero on their own hardware, and that's always a bit like you. When the new version comes out, you will try the new features, so you always have another chance,
right,
to introduce yourself to people. But you've got to take those chances.
You've got to take those chances.
Yeah. I'll say this: it is the one of the things that kind of put me off initially. Selecting the Google Assistant as my default home speaker system was that it's. Bum, 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 bum. Okay, Guillermo. That's four syllables. The other, it's less personable to say, okay, name of software product by a corporation name linked to it. However, isn't it interesting that both Shlomo and Alyosha, I'm starting to regret those choices, but that... But the thing is, it's gender nonspecific. That it is, yes, it's a female voice but you could very trivially, you don't have to recast the character by saying, oh, by the way, here's a male voice, or a British sounding voice that nonetheless uses American idioms and in American language. I wouldn't say that's a transformative and a hugely positive thing. I do think it's a positive thing that we don't have all of our servants be women. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's different.
I also say,
like,
Shlomo's a guy.
Yeah, in England, it defaults to a guy. Different geographies test it differently for. Yeah.
I use a male Shlomo.
Alexa doesn't. Alyosha doesn't have a male counterpart, does he?
No, Alyosha is always a woman.
Alexei.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
Actually, that's a really good idea. Yeah.
The Pixel Core has an Alex, just not Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a break. Lots more to talk about coming up in just a little bit. But first, a word from Texture. It's like so nice to have it on your iPad or your iPhone or any tablet or Android device and have great reading always available for you. I'm looking at the highlights section right now, which is the first thing that pops up on Texture. And there's some really great curated articles. Stories just for me include things that are unique to me, like an insider's guide to the Bay Area, new and noteworthy stories. If you like politics, man, the best coverage anywhere. If you're curious about gossip, did you know Gwyneth Paltrow is going to give marriage a second shot? What? And you get what? And you get, by the way, every page that's in the magazines on the newsstand, plus back issues, plus bonus features. Oh, Consumer Reports ranking the tastiest pizzas. Now I've got to read this. And the user interface is great. What it's really good for photography magazines like National Geographic or Shutterfly, because you can, you know, pictures on an iPad look 10 times better than the printed versions of the pictures. So you can really, if you like pixel peeping, you can really get in. Oh, that pizza looks. You can really get into it. I am just a huge fan of Texture. Yes, you get Consumer Reports, the National Geographic, Vanity Fair, the New Yorker. Yes, you get Wired and PC Magazine, all the magazines. Huge. There's always an article. You know, I have a go-to maybe five or six magazines that I look at every month. Some of them are weekly, like the New Yorker, look at every week. But then, because you have 200 magazines, you discover new stuff, you find more magazines. And the things like the cooking magazines, like Bon Appetit, I wouldn't probably subscribe to them, but the fact that if I need a recipe, I can go there, see images, get great recipes that are tried out by really good chefs. Look at All Recipes, Better Homes and Gardens. What is that? Chatelaine? I love that. Clean eating, cooking light, diabetic living, eating well, food and wine, draft if you're a beer lover, food magazine from the Food Network, living. I mean, there's plenty of recipes alone. I mean, this is wine enthusiast, Weight Watchers. And it doesn't stop there. There's stuff in my industry like Ad Age and Billboard that I couldn't afford to subscribe to all these magazines. But the fact that I could check the Billboard charts just as kind of part of my texture subscription, that makes it fantastic. Start your free texture trial right now at texture, T-E-X-T-U-R-E, texture.com/twit. We have a special price, and that you really want to use this. If you choose to continue, you're going to get a 30% reduction on their listed price, $9.99 a month. So don't go anywhere else. Texture.com/twit to start your free trial today. And if you like it, $10 a month gives you more than 200 of the best magazines in the world. Texture.com/twit. They have foreign language magazines, too. You can learn Spanish or French. That's a great way to learn a language, is to read magazines in the language. Texture.com/twit. I mentioned I ordered this Rove Viva, which is puts Amazon's Echo in your car. I will have it early February that comes, and I will give you for sure a review of it. But so many automobiles now are going to have, and there are a few places where voice makes sense. Home automation in the car. And I have to say, I use Siri on my Apple, Shlomo on my Apple Watch all the time. So it's clear that a lot of what makes or breaks these voice-activated devices is the environment.
I want that system to be where I yes. available to me whenever I want to use it. Yes. And I agree. Even on my Android Wear watch, that's probably one of the most useful things to do. Yeah. Also, I feel like Dick Tracy.
Well, but yeah, you really don't. That's the problem with watches, is the user interface. It's too small a screen. There's no good user right. interface. Voice is the best user interface in certain.
I don't know if I should say this or not, but I was driving to another city over the holidays, and in the middle of the drive, I got a comment on a story, and I was sitting there and I was bringing my mom with me, and as we were driving, I just saw the thing come up, and I said, read the message, and I got the message, and then I told Siri to open up the app. And my mom can help me with some of this stuff, but we basically cut and pasted it. I kept telling Siri to open different apps. We would paste the thing in and actually got it up and wow. tweeted out and into the story while I was driving the city. That's using Siri and a tapping assistant. I dictate whole into drafts. I dictate whole article ideas, and it's not perfect, but it's enough that I don't forget what I want to say. And it's not trivial, but it's easy to take that and then turn it into a finished product when I get home. Otherwise, I think 9 out of 10 times I'd forget what I wanted to say or not be able to work on it.
If you have an Apple Watch and an iOS device, I got to give you guys a plug. You had Merlin Mann on, and the creator, yeah. Angel Tortoise, the creator of Drafts, on. And this is
Greg Pierce. Yeah.
It's not immediately obvious how you might use this. Just get it and trust me, because basically I dump everything I'm trying to remember into my watch. If somebody asks me to do something, if I make an appointment, if I'm trying to remember a TV show or a book, I just tell my watch. It then ends up in Drafts on iOS, and then I process it at the end of the day.
It's time shift for text.
It's a really good example of voice and the watch being, it's incredibly useful, and I almost entirely use it on my watch, at least as the input device.
I use it on my phone when I'm driving. I got that car mount I mentioned last week. I just have it in there, and I can just say, yo, Shlomo, and then it just does things for me. And some of the times it makes amazingly comedic errors, but most of the time people don't even know that I'm using it.
I'll tell you, if somebody's watching who works with Grigorovich or Alyosha, we might as well make it all Russian, right? Then you should consider
Karamazov brothers.
The Karamazovs. You should consider adding a drafts-like capability to those devices, because that would, to me, be incredible. You can kind of do it with Shlomo, where you say "remind me too," but the point of Drafts is it doesn't just do reminders; it does everything. You later decide where it goes. What you want is somewhere you just dump snippets of voice Well, they become texts, snippets of voice to text in a thing that you can then process later. You know what?
It's like L3 cache for your brain.
Yeah. He actually, what's his name? Greg Pierce?
Yeah, Greg Pierce.
Should really do an Echo skill for drafts. I bet he could. That would be a killer.
I do, actually, on your recommendation, I have it on my Mac and I have it on my iPad. I just wish it were on my phone. I just wish I could get it to work on the voice assistant that I want to use. It's
because you're using Android.
Yeah. I miss it on Windows. It's moving me back into the Mac. I miss it on Android and I miss it on Windows.
You need it. What we're going to get it. You know what? Let's talk to Greg. Let's get it on the Echo.
I'm sure he's listening. Greg, you heard me.
Because it's good enough to do it on my watch, but it would be really nice if I could just say it out loud.
Yeah.
Hey,
Google Home first. I think that would be the smart move. Only because I use Google Home before I use that.
Well, this is, by the way, one of the reasons Echo has an advantage is because the API and the skills. I mean, they have 25,000 skills. I mean, that is a huge advantage for Echo. It's kind of like a massive app store, and I don't know how easy it is to write Google skills.
They didn't have all the services that Apple and Google have built, and they had to figure out a way to make an assistant that could be useful without having their own messaging service and their own everything else to build around.
So you talked to Apple about this. I thought this was really interesting. There are two activist investors at Apple. There's the Janus Fund, which I think everybody knows. They're kind of one of the noisiest of the activist investors. And then there's CalSTRS, which is the California Teachers Pension Fund. And they wrote a letter to Apple saying, you better start thinking about smartphone overuse and addiction among kids, because if you don't address this now, it could come back to bite you. I think it's unprecedented for shareholders of a company to tell a company your product is dangerous. You got to do something about it.
It's both the best and worst thing for Apple, because Apple, by far and away, I mean, Microsoft does some interesting things too, but Apple's been doing parental controls for years. They're very good at it. Yeah, I don't think Google has much of anything in terms of this. And there's no like shareholder activists about Google. It's like immediately when there's a problem, it's Apple's problem.
Oh, yeah.
And immediately when we want something, we want it from Apple. And I think that's great in terms of mind share. But Apple has done there's some interesting parts of this. One is that Apple's done a ton of stuff with parental controls, with restrictions, and they have since iOS 2 and I think Mac OS Tiger. They could always be better. Apple also has Configurator and they have Classroom for Education, which if you want, you can use on your kids or anybody's iPhone or iPad. But those are meant to be IT solutions, and you sort of need to know IT things, or like a Fraser Spears can manage the heck out of an iPhone, or anyone who does IT can use Configurator to do some amazing things with an iPhone, but those aren't really accessible to parents. And we need something that's a little bit better or more granular. Like I think a lot of people just want timeouts, for example, like shut this device down after so long, but it has to be much easier to use than enterprise, like mobile device management solutions.
And actually it was Megan Maroney on iOS Today earlier who reminded me of this. Apple, simply with their don't text while driving feature, which they put in iOS 11, is easily the best in the business on this stuff. I mean, they've really done a good job, I think. But
totally. And I wanted to have
Jana Partners is starting a socially responsible investing fund, and Sting and his wife are on the board and stuff like that. So they have this is kind of promotional for Jana. California State Teachers Retirement System, I think, probably because their teachers has some interest in this.
But this is the same thing with accessibility. Like, please make this an industry discussion. I can't count how many times I've seen accessibility on an Apple stage. I don't think I've almost ever seen it on a Google stage or other companies. And this is not what about it. And this is something that I want as a consumer of all these companies. I want them all held to Apple-like standards. It is better for all of us if they do that.
Apple gets all the heat because they got the most successful phone. Frankly.
And good. Just give that heat to everybody, please. I want them all to be doing this for me.
Yeah,
and Apple did say they're going to make more stuff.
Yeah. And Google has had a lot of coverage in about accessibility and stuff like that in their events. But I absolutely agree that this really should be a complaint about all phones in general, all devices in general, and not just about Apple. And it's easy to figure out why they decided to highlight Apple in this.
Yeah.
But this is going to be a bigger and bigger problem. I mean, I've been taking a look at child activity trackers, the fitness bands that are designed for children. And that, okay, that's kind of okay. That's nice that you're sort of able to make sure that your kids have an awareness of how much they're active or not active during the day. But these add horrifying features to me, where it has things like chore tracking and reward tracking, so that if they make their bed, basically their parents can monitor what they're doing, and they can communicate between the devices so that they get certain rewards if they do certain chores. And that's for lazy butts like me, that can be a very handy way to, you know, to kick me in the butt and say, you know, you are going to clean the floors today. You're going to move the furniture out of the way. You're going to dry mop. You're going to wet mop. You're going to do all that stuff, and because it's on the schedule, and I won't let you access Instagram until you actually get this done. Okay, fine. But when you're talking about giving this to like a 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, where they're being trained that the reason why I'm making my bed in the morning is because I want to minimize mouse to do the little dance, and I want to be able to get tokens that I can use to play a game on my phone later on. I really do. I want to see some studies into what that does to this kid as an adult when they are always linking, if I do this for a tangible and immediate and clear reward, as opposed to the reason why you clean your room regularly is because if you don't, in a month, you will not be able to see you won't be able to find anything you own. You won't be able to, you'll be surrounded by filth. There is no immediate tangible reward to cleaning your room except for having a clean room and an orderly life.
For someone who has no kids, you're right on, Andy. And I think there are a lot of parents who in fact, we didn't do this, will not tie rewards to chores. That's just your job. You just have to do that. It's part of being in the family, because they don't want to create that connection. But the point here is not that Apple would do that either. What Apple needs to do, and what they're calling on Apple to do, and every company to do, is to provide the tools parents need to choose how they do this.
Right.
So it's about empowering parents, not about putting in
Absolutely. I mean that it's good that we continue to have conversations about what happens when you have a human being that is still in development, that their brain is still cooking, they're still writing their operational software, and if they're if there's a layer of glass between their brains and their perceptions of reality, what effect does that have in 20 years' time? At least it's worth studying.
No, I
always
agree.
Defer to Georgia on stuff like this because she's way smarter than me. But she has kids, and she's got a degree in education, and she's a full-time therapist. But the interesting thing with this is that Apple can only offer technological solutions to this. And when you talk about the effects of screen time on children, even on adults, but on children too, it has to be a balance. There has to be parenting. Apple can't make a cyber babysitter, nor should they make a cyber babysitter for you. The most powerful way to prevent your kids having screen time is to prevent them from having screen time. And this is not new. This is don't put the computer in their room. Put it in the living room. This is don't give them constant access to a phone, because you can put a timeout on it. But if they don't have the phone, they can't be using the phone. So I think it's a larger societal question about the roles and responsibilities of parenting and the children that we're raising and how technology and what the technology companies can do to help with it. But there's still ultimately parenting issues.
Jimmy Iovine leaving Apple in August.
Parenting issues.
Exactly when his stocks vest.
Supposedly. Reportedly.
Reportedly. Remember, of course, that Iovine and Dr. Dre sold Beats to Apple for $3.2 billion 4 years ago. And
he wants to spend more time with his money.
Yeah. But, you know, he's also 64. I mean, it's not inappropriate for him to retire.
Well, and he rolled out Apple Music, and now Apple's getting into entertainment that is beyond just music. So he might have been there and done what he needed to do.
Been there, done that. Apple, yeah. Speaking of that, Apple's really expanding.
Yeah.
They ordered a documentary from the producer of Rock of Ages. They gave an order to a series order to a show about extraordinary homes. They're developing a video series with the creator of Serial, based on the novel Are You Sleeping? And they've picked this is all this week. And they picked up Reese Witherspoon's thriller starring Octavia Spencer.
Yep.
Clearly, Apple is spreading its $1 billion around, and I bet you it's going to be more than $1 billion by the time they're done. They realize if they're going to compete with the $8 billion that Netflix is spending, although Netflix has done too much, maybe. It's so much original stuff on Netflix, you don't even know.
They have different problems. Like, Netflix is their product, and they have to always have enough content that you want to maintain your Netflix subscription.
And they're losing movies from the studios, right?
So, yeah, and yeah. It's like HBO wants you to sign up for Game of Thrones, but Netflix wants you to be there for Bright and for Stranger Things. It always has to be something. Where Apple, again, this is a vehicle to make more money off of iPhones by creating a richer overall ecosystem. They just have to have enough. And I don't know if they keep calling it Apple Music when it starts having all this video content, but they have to have enough that when you buy an iPhone, you're like, well, look at all this extra stuff I get with it. And that's a much smaller entertainment space to solve for.
Yeah, it's easy to make fun of them at this stage because they're starting the race so many years late. But the best time to start any great idea is 3-4 years ago. They have to start sometime. And look at what Amazon Prime service has done, where I still associate it with free 2-day shipping, but the list of things I get for free simply by having this account is kind of staggering. And sometimes a really great series can be a very valuable loss leader, so to speak. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel got me making sure that the Amazon video app is on every single device I have.
It's so
it was
good.
On all
two
of them.
Two Golden Globes and Jeff Bezos was in the audience.
Amy Sherman Palladino.
Yeah. And I loved Amy Sherman Palladino's top hat.
Yeah. And just like the Crown, if there's a Netflix system. Oh God, and it reminds you how valuable that subscription is. And given that every single music service has pretty much the same collection of albums, even when they have exclusives, they don't have those exclusives forever. All you have to do is extend the free period from 30 days to 60 to 90 days, and then make sure that every 60 to 90 days you have some sort of original content that is that everybody is talking about, that's sweeping the Golden Globes. But not only that, but on Twitter, everybody, and on Instagram, everybody that is on Facebook, everybody that's in your social circle is asking you, have you started watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel yet? No. Okay, watch the first episode. No, watch episode 4 and then get back to me. And then
I finished it, and it is very, very good, deserved. And she is really great. Bresnahan deserved her Golden Globe, too. She's just 26 years old. We're going to see a lot more of her. She's a superstar. CES is going on. Oh, who knew? We're not there.
Got a whole team there.
We're not there. Apple doesn't have a booth there, but boy, Apple has a presence there. A lot of HomeKit support coming out. Belkin has announced its Wemo line.
Finally
starting January 14th, there'll be a Wemo bridge for $40. That'll allow you to control with HomeKit Wemo Switch, Insight, Light Switch, Mini, Dimmer, and Motion. That's good news if you're all in on HomeKit and Siri. Let's see what else do we have.
So much HomeKit stuff in the last week, Leo.
NanoLeaf made a 12-sided Apple HomeKit remote that looks like a 12-sided die.
If that's not like rubberized and made sure that you can actually use it in gaming, they're just idiots. I think that there should be a class action suit. That is an attractive nuisance if they do not expect someone to at some point.
As you play D&D, your lights and everything change.
Well, it really does tempt you to say, well, I've got this programmed with 12 different scenes. Let's see what we get today. Apple Watch users can control select Whirlpool washers, dryers, and ovens early this year. Not sure why you'd want to set your wash cycle with your watch.
One of my worst CES memories was 2 years ago when I walked into Showstoppers and there was this PR woman there and she was just like, make it stop. Make it stop. And the person's looking at her. She goes, this effing Android dishwasher was texting me all night. I could not sleep. Make it stop. And I'm like, okay, we've really jumped the shark.
It's not about controlling stuff. It really is about communication. Like the only reason why I have like the Bluetooth app on my sous vide device is just to know has the device come up to temperature yet?
Right.
And then just to know, and also has it turned off? Has the oven is the oven up to temperature when I'm cooking pizza and stuff like that? So that's cool stuff. And home automation is one of those few categories where almost nobody is interested in creating something that is exclusive to one platform, because they know that things are really in flux right now. There's huge competition. And so there is, unless there's a deep deeply disturbing technical reason why you can't make something work with HomeKit, they're going to make sure that it works with every single platform that can take use of it.
I did talk to a developer, though, who makes a device that would be very appropriate for HomeKit, who said it's so much easier for us to implement Amazon's Echo support. We're working on HomeKit, but it's not easy.
You didn't need to use any security previously for Amazon.
Maybe that's
Apple's going to do away with the MFI chip, but I think they're still going to maintain the end-to-end encryption part.
Yeah. NetAtmo is adding HomeKit to its welcome indoor camera by the end of March. Of course you want all IoT devices to support HomeKit, but again, it requires some investment, both in time and money for the company.
My thing now is I bought a ton of HomeKit stuff for the place I'm moving into, and a lot of them have their own subscription services. Well, they'll store all your data for you, and I'm like, nope. Yeah. And I wish I had alternatives. Like, I wish I could just store, I don't need Logitech or I don't need Nest to store video for me. Just let me point it at my home server. And they're like, no WebDAV API for you,
and
idiot.
It really adds up. It really adds up. It's not.
But I also, I don't want my video of my home being stored anywhere on the internet. Thank you.
No, that's something right. I got, fortunately, after cleaning out like my old house and all the closets and all the garage boxes, I came across like all the Avios like Ethernet webcams that I like put away like 3, 4, 5 years ago, not knowing that when the next time I move, I'm going to enjoy, just like Renee says, all I want is something that connects to my network that allows me to look out the window to see if the UPS truck is pulling up the street. I don't need motion tracking. I don't have to sign into an account to make that happen. I just want to hold up my phone and realize that, no, I can stay in bed for another 8 minutes.
Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, is at CES. So is Dick D. Bartolo, Scott Wilkinson, and who else? We have a number of people down there, and we will have reports throughout the week. Tech News Weekly will have reports. And, of course, Father Robert Ballester will be back from Vegas on Saturday and co-hosting the new Screensavers with me. So we will have
more CES coverage. Unless he drives away in that electric supercar. He just toots the horn.
We decided. We used to go down there and we'd do a big booth and stuff. And not only was it horrifically expensive, but at this point, the show is so overcovered. How many people did you send down there?
We actually cut down hugely for the same reasons you mentioned. We sent two from Android Central, two from Windows Central. Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, and an assistant went. And my boss, Kevin, went because he had to manage the whole thing. I think so, maybe 8 people.
Yeah.
Daniel Bader.
Yeah. I mean, we used to send twice as many down, spend $500,000 on equipment and storage and hotels and food. And Gadget's got its own trailer. The Verge has its own trailer.
Trailers for their trailers now, Leo.
It's more than amply covered. So I feel like we send a few people down, but we can do as well as we need to just by sitting here and looking.
Yeah. Every year, it's a lot of the same. Every year it was 3D TVs, and then every year it was 4K TVs, and then every year it was drones.
I'm very interested in Scott Wilkinson, before he left on Saturday, said, I can't tell you because I'm embargoed, but there is a new TV technology which will be shown at CES. Then we'll talk about it Saturday on the Tech Guy show, and I don't know what that is. But
I know I got jealous because I have that LG OLED TV, and the new LG OLED TV is colorier. It has more color. It has higher color depth or something. So now I'm missing the color that I didn't know I was missing.
Every time I sit down and watch my now almost 2 years old LG B, I guess it's a B16. Yeah. I don't know. It's from 2016.
I have the 7C.
Yeah, 6C I have. B6 I have. I thank God I bought it. It is just gorgeous. And now there's so much content. I was watching Chance, an Amazon show last night, and 4K HDR just looks great. And
I went to iTunes, Leo, and I pressed the button, and it said, you've got the HDR version of Die Hard and Harry Potter and The Fifth Element, and my Christmas was just done. I knew what I was doing.
And I have it in a darkened room with a surround system. We only sit about 8 feet from the screen, so it pretty much fills your vision, and it's a better experience than going to the movie
theater. The Fifth Element and HDR, it's amazing.
In fact, now that Blade Runner 2049 is out, I'm going to give it a second chance, because I saw it in the movie theater in 3D. It was dim, dark, and I didn't like it. But I know everybody else loved it, so I want to watch it again.
It was like Prometheus for me. I loved the beginning. Didn't land the ending for me.
Yeah, I loved Prometheus' beginning too. Yeah.
I like the whole thing, but I'm going to give you two like an opportunity to advise me. Now, it's time for me to buy a new TV because the old one is 10 years old now. It still works, but it has fluorescent backlighting, and now you get in dark scenes, like in Blade Runner, there's like sort of an Instagram effect happening at the edges of the screen. Yep. And I'm going back to my usual TV buying algorithm, which is I want to buy all it has to be is like have 4K and HDR and cost not under $500, but not more than $1,000. So I'm probably going to be getting like a TCL, like a six. It costs like $600 or $700.
I don't know.
Maybe between 50 and 60.
I think the 55 inch OLED has come down.
Yeah, so you can get last year's model when the new one comes out and save. And
LG is just running circles, and they support Dolby Vision, which a lot of other TVs don't, which is just.
But in your budget, remember, and this is something people forget, everything has to be upgraded. You need a new AV receiver that supports 4K. You need a Roku, a Chromecast, an Apple TV. Everything has to support 4K, or you just there's no point.
Well, I did future proof. I got when I bought my AV receiver, I bought the cheapest one that'll support 4K and all the content perfection standards of that. My TV box is the NVIDIA Shield, which already supports 4K HDR. Yep. It's just that every time from time to time, a company will send me like a $2,000 or $3,000 TV in a box the size of a mattress, and it's nice, but it never blows me away. That this is I can say when I put it side by side with a normal budget sort of TV set, I can definitely see the improvement, but it's not like the difference between like SD and HD where it's like I never want to go back again. So it's always hard for me
HDR
to spend.
Will impress
like,
you.
HDR is mind-boggling.
HDR absolutely. No, I've had a couple of HDR sets in the office for a couple of years, and that's like it's almost I love it because it's almost like. It's a people pleasing feature. It's like the reason why you can buy an $800 TV that looks as good as a $4,000 TV might have 2 years ago. Just the ability to say, let's make sure that there are actual blacks here. Let's make sure there's detail in the whites. That's just like it's even more important than 4K. I think this is you will absolutely notice it.
I agree 100%. It'd be nice to get OLED, but that's what really puts you out of the price range. The B6 that I have, the 2016 55 inch LG, is $1,500. But I noticed that Sony's selling a 2016 4K HDR 55 inch for $848. This is a very nice one. It's just LCD. It's not OLED. Yeah. If you can afford OLED, it's worth it. But this is a beautiful set. You'd be very
happy. Micro LED ships in volume.
if I were to steal a TV out of someone else's house, I would definitely be going for the OLED. It's just it's hard for me to see the difference, as good as the difference is, to say, yes, but what can I do for $1,000? Here's like the better speakers that I can get, and here's all the movies that I could buy, and I'm actually thinking one of the silly things I'm gonna buy this year is maybe a turntable, because I still can't get the movie soundtrack to the musical 1776 anywhere. They've got the Broadway CD, which has some different cast members and some different songs. And so maybe this would be the most expensive single album I've ever bought in my life, to buy a record player just so I can get 1776. But it will be a fun adventure. That's what I mean about getting value for money. I don't think I will get value for the extra $1,000 I've spent for OLED as much as I would get by spending $200 or $300 for another component that would be kind of fun to have.
It's true that micro LED, I don't know when that'll be out, but that could be the big thing. That's the technology Scott was talking about. I'm guessing he didn't tell us.
We'll see like a $25,000 one first, and then we'll all look at it and go, ah. Yeah.
So the idea, though, is it's direct view. They're basically doing what OLED does, but they're doing it with LEDs, and they're using gallium nitride instead of the organic stuff which means it'll last longer. But you hear about these things. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be in the store.
Yeah.
No, well, plasma was $25,000. Then OLED was $25,000. Yeah. It all starts that way.
So by the time you're ready for a new TV, maybe you'll get a micro LED.
That's always the most fun part of CES, year after year after year. Who wants to win the crown as the best stupid TV out there? Where this gets, so because like Samsung will have now we have the 273-inch 12K display, and actually this has like servo control pixels to make it not just 3D with glasses, but it will make sure that like the cars will actually like stick out and create shadows that are natural to the lighting. And you know that there are people that have that kind of a money, and they will they buy a new TV every 8 months, or they hire people to replace their TVs every 8 months, but they only have to ever make the one because it's never going to be on the market for anywhere.
Actually, interestingly enough, in 2014, Apple bought a company called LuxView that does micro LED. Yep.
There's been rumors that Apple Watch will be the first one to adopt it because it's
Size. So you might see micro LED displays from Apple at some point. They've had this for 3 years. But we don't know why. Let's take a break. That's our CES update. And I'm sure there'll be much more coming up. Our back of the book, the picks of the week. But first, I got a pick for you, and it's on my watch or keychain. It's on everything I've got. It's on my bike. It's in my luggage. It's called the Tracker, and it's the best way to make sure you can find the stuff you own, but you can't find. Don't spend hours every day searching for your keys or your remote controls. Get the Tracker. This is the new Tracker Pixel. It's about the size of a dime, really lightweight. It's the smallest, lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market today. But like all the trackers, replaceable batteries mean it goes and goes and goes. You put it on whatever you need to keep track of your keys, your wallet. It's small enough to fit in your wallet. Your remote control, of course, and it has powerful LED lights. It's great for a remote because a lot of times the remote, you can't find it because it slipped down behind the cushions. Well, the lights make it easy to find. It also has a very loud alarm. Now, the alarm is useful for a couple of reasons. One is two-way separation alerts. So you put the Tracker app on your phone. That's how you find your trackered stuff. But also, if you leave your trackered stuff behind, your phone can howl at you. So it basically is like Find My iPhone for your keys or whatever you've attached your tracker to. I love that idea. Vice versa, too. If you can't find your phone, you press the button on the tracker. You don't have to go to the computer and fire up Find My iPhone. Just press the button on the tracker. The phone, even if it's silenced, will make loud noises. And the Crowd Locate Network is something unique. 5 million trackers out there means that everywhere in the world, there are people running the Tracker app. And when they see your purse or your keys or your luggage, when they walk by with the app running on their phone, the app without, you know, just automatically says, I saw them. They're right here. It's awesome. Tracker. And then with a 30-day money-back guarantee, you've got nothing to lose. And the app actually lets you order new batteries if you get low. It tells you you're getting low and you can get a new battery. It's very easy to put them in. I've done that a couple of times already on my many tracker devices. Go to thetracker.com/MacBreak so you can get many tracker devices. They've got great prices on bundles right now. And no matter what you order, take 20% off when you use our website, thetracker.com/MacBreak. 20% off on any order. Tell your friends, thetracker.com/MacBreak. And I personally thank Tracker more than once helping me find my stuff. My favorite story, I told it earlier today, is when I lost my keys in my Scotty Vest shirt.
Oh, no.
Because it's got so many pockets. And I couldn't find my keys. And I thought I left them somewhere. And I was looking all over. And then I went to the bar I thought I left them at. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute. I have the tracker on them. I opened the phone, pressed the tracker button, and my shirt starts making noise. Oh, I've had them all along. All right, time for your picks of the week. Let's start with Andy Inoko. Andy?
One of my favorite things I've put onto my Mac in quite a long time, FlexiBits. They're the makers of Fantastical. Came out with a contact utility called CardHop.
Love it!
That, oh my goodness. It's everything. It's, you can... and this is true of this, what I'm about to say is true of Mac OS, is true of Windows, is true of everything. You can always tell the stuff that nobody at the company wants to work on. And the contacts manager at any operating system, nobody thinks that's a cool thing to work on. So that's why it looks like 2004, 2005. CardHop is a menulet that will essentially make your Mac OS contacts database as useful as a phone app. You just type in a partial name, it will immediately populate. Here is the contact you're looking for. What do you want to do with it? Just by clicking, I want to send a message, I want to send an email, I want to call this person, I want to edit this sort of thing. It doesn't matter how you put that information into the database, it will surface it for you. So it's not as though you forgot to put the company name where it should have been. It's good for organizing. It's good for exporting. It's not a complicated app. It's just a simple drop down from your menu bar, but it works exactly the way you would hope a contacts database would work. I got to say that I had written off the macOS built-in contacts app so long ago that now I just go into my mail client and look for an email that person has sent me that will probably have a phone number attached to the end of it, because that kind of search works a lot better for me. But CardHop is quickly corrected that behavior. It's $20. It's not cheap, but oh my goodness, you will totally. If you go directly to flexibits.com, you can download a free like 21-day trial. But you will probably, as I did, spend the $20 very, very quickly and then forget about any amount of money you spend for it. It's really superb.
I use it and Fantastic Health 2 together on my Mac. And by the way, we're talking about drafts. Works so great because I could just send stuff. And all of the FlexiBit stuff has kind of natural language it interprets.
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh, yeah, man, exactly. it's such a killer combination.
Just the ability. I can't believe that even in this day and age, I'm thinking, I wish that contacts and stuff like that worked as well as it did in my Newton message pad in the late 90s. Like, why can't I just type Andy Anatko, 1313 Mockingbird Lane, Tulsa, Oklahoma, 617-444-1414. Like, okay, you know what? There's enough information here that I bet you can figure out that bum 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 bum. That's probably a phone number, and that looks like an address, doesn't it? That looks like a first name and a last name. Why should I even have to tab between fields to tell it where things should go? And the way that you can simply just cut and paste things from a web page or wherever, or an email into CardHop, and boom, you've got a contact. Oh my goodness, why are we waiting so long for this to happen? Apple, just buy it. Make it rain. Fly them in first class.
Get Michael and
fly
them in. Hire them.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I want an iPhone CardHop. I'm sure they're working on it.
Yeah, I keep asking. But my favorite thing about it is that humans aren't great at context switching. So if I say I want to contact Andy, I have to go and find the app, and then I forget what I want to do, because then I got to find Andy in the app. And with this, it's just like I type Andy, and then I can make him phone. I can send an email. I can send a message. Like, it's person first, and it's the way my brain works, and it's just so much faster.
I'm using something called Full Contact on iOS right now, but I would replace it with CardHop as soon as I can. I mean, Apple's contact and calendar are bare minimum. They work.
You could tell the stuff that Steve Jobs' assistant used instead of Steve Jobs.
It's what we used to call a third-party opportunity.
Yes, I agree. They're not bad.
Isn't that nice of Apple? They're creating a third-party opportunity.
You can Moriarty Apple. Like, they Sherlock enough apps. You can Moriarty them right back.
Renee, your pick of the week.
My pick of the week. So this is just for fun. This is for lulz. This is from CES. And as far as I know, it's not quite available yet. But I saw it, and I thought it would be fun to share. And that is, Kohler announced a bunch of, I don't know how to pronounce it, Kohler. It's called Kohler Connect. So they make all these bathroom
accessories.
So seriously, there's a mirror that you can have different lighting settings if you want to do different makeup effects. There's a bath, and you could say Shlomo or Alexi, whatever. Bath Earl Grey hot, and then it'll just bubbles Earl Grey hot, and it'll just do it for you. The toilet will flush for you. It'll warm for you. The shower will turn on.
It plays music for you.
It does. It'll have like and it'll control like light. Like, you can mesh it with your lighting and your music. So you walk into the shower and it's like boom, 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 uns, 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 lasers as you're going. And I know like these are early days. It's not Star Trek yet, but you can go to the faucet and say 8 ounces of 30-degree water. I don't know what that is in Celsius and Fahrenheit, like 973-degree water.
Oh,
and it'll just pour
cool.
the exact
That'd be nice.
Amount for you.
Yeah.
And again, like, these are the first generations. They probably don't have the longevity that we'll eventually have with these products. But just that we have this stuff now, mommy potty, warm, hot. Don't have to touch it. hey, device, flush.
Toilet, seat down, warm.
Toilet, so, wash my buttocks.
You could actually work out in your shower with all this nonsense. It's just, this is the future, Leo, and it's coming sooner.
I already saw the future. You ever been in an airport bathroom where none of the hand-activated devices work? You can't turn on a faucet. You can't get soap. You can't get towels. Nothing works.
The internet is down. You can't shower.
I've seen the future, and it's got some problems.
I think all this stuff is manual, though, too, so you can go full-on Galactica if you want to. Okay. But it'd be nice, like, in the morning you wake up and you say shower, you know, shower 20 degrees or whatever. Again, whatever it is in Fahrenheit. It's only three countries that use it. I can't understand it anymore, Leo. But it would be nice when this stuff begins preemptive. Like, it knows that when you wake up, and as soon as it detects your phone lifting, it knows you're awake, so you're going to want to shower, and it turns it on for you, and it turns the lights on, and starts brewing the coffee, and it just starts helping, like the predictive execution stuff that we're getting. We're getting one step closer to that.
I can see this happening. I can, and I wouldn't mind it.
The connected pooper.
As long as it works. Because I can see a vision where the batteries are down on everything. You gotta crawl
I've just got great advice for Apple. Okay, we talked about how Siri seems to have fallen behind. Here's how they reclaim all of that and then take a lead that no one can match them. Stephen Fry is a big fan of Apple things. You have Stephen Fry in his Jeeves voice for all this home automation stuff. Sir, your bath water is at the appropriate temperature.
Oh, he's Jarvis. Stephen Fry is Jarvis.
You've seen the Stephen Fry alarm clock, right?
Yes, I have. I own the Stephen Fry.
Do
alarm
you?
Clock.
I'm so jealous. Yes. I would love to.
Why would you use the bird setting? Why would you?
Excuse me, madam. Your horoscope advises a demonstration of courage in the face of adverse circumstances. Very good, madam.
I just feel like I want Stephen Fry to wake me up in the morning. I don't have a pick. We got to get my pick is let's get going to security now because Steve wants to talk all about Meltdown and Spectre and
just sitting there going.
We're running a little bit late. We're running a little bit late. So let's wrap this puppy up. We do Mac Break Weekly right after iOS today because kind of like they both go together, right? Like peanut butter and jelly. You can tune in 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern. That's 1700 UTC to start your day with iOS today. And following immediately after, generally around, we shoot for 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC for Mac Break Weekly. That's every Tuesday. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. There's somebody there all the time, 24/7. I go in there. Middle of the night, there's people chatting in there. It's a lot of fun. In the evenings, they have music. They have a DJ. It's great. It's a party. irc.twit.tv. Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. Dale Poco. It's called Poco Radio. It's wild. If you can't watch live, and by the way, you are invited to visit us in the studio, but we do ask that you email us first. We don't like surprises. tickets@twit.tv, and let us know you're coming. We'll be glad to have you visit us in the studio, watch the show live if you want, pose for a picture afterwards if you like. But if you can't do any of that, on-demand audio and video of everything we do available at our website, twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/MBW. And, of course, you probably use Overcast or Pocket Cast or Apple's podcast app. You just subscribe in there, and you will get your very own copy automatically delivered, piping hot, and fresh to your device so you can listen at your leisure. Thank you for being here. Now it's time to get back to work. Because guess what? Break time is over. Bye-bye.